You are listening to Demise of the Podcast with Patrick Attaway, my podcast where I discuss writing only. We're continuing the Nero series with 2143. Yes, this week I remembered because I just finished recording it. I'm recording these sort of out of order, so I recorded the main part of this episode before the intro, and the last two were recorded days apart, so if you're interested in that behind the scenes sort of crap. I've also recorded even more music for this, and I went live on Twitter as I recorded three songs, and I ended up keeping two of them, so you'll probably hear them in this episode. There's also a song that I recorded for the original part of the soundtrack that hasn't been used yet that gets to be used for a certain character in this story, and it'll be used again for him in the subsequent chapters. So, if you're not aware of this podcast and you're listening for the first time, this is not the normal format of the podcast, and I will continue in that direction after I finish this series. So, I know I said that I was going to release it over the course of 6 weeks, but I don't know that I can keep that promise. I'll probably release them sooner than that, just because I want to get back to the normal grind or format, rather, of this. I wouldn't call doing this podcast a grind. It's usually pretty easy for me, other than having to stop because I keep mixing up words or I sound too much like an idiot. But I have a lot to complain about, but I guess I should save that for future episodes. I'm going through the shit lately because I'm teaching for the first time, and I'm only teaching one class, but that one class is proving difficult in some ways. And my professor from my African American lit class last year told us that he liked all of us. He said, "I don't have to lie and say that I like all of you, because a lot of times I have classrooms where I don't like many students. There are always students that I don't like. They have an attitude, or, you know, they're just not doing their work. And I find that I don't like all of my students. I like many of them, sure. And most of them are actually doing a good job, or relatively. But it's difficult because this is my first go around and I'm learning alongside them. And I don't know. New teachers generally get a bad rap, and you can always tell when you get a new teacher. And some of them are overtly strict, and some of them are overtly lax because they're just figuring things out. If you want to support the podcast, the first thing I need you to do is tell your friends, your family, your enemies all about it. You need to share the link. You need to retweet it. You need to share it on social media. You need to help me out because I can only do so much. People don't realize that if they just try a little for the people that they love, because I'm not a celebrity, I don't have free media coverage. So if you want to help out and you want to support the podcast, retweet my pinned tweets, because I usually have a link to the podcast there. You can go buy my books on Amazon, on Kindle. Most of them are 99 cents. My novels are a little bit more than that. I have paperbacks. I'm going to have a new paperback called Parked in the Flower Bed next month in November that's going to collect my last four books of poetry in one volume. So look forward to that. I just had my latest book of poetry, my ninth book of poetry, Iconic Misery, come out this month. Back in July, I had Birch come out, which was my fourth novel. So I have a lot for you to check out. And if you like the music in this episode of the podcast, you can go find it in, well, you can find more stuff by me. You can't necessarily find this whole soundtrack on Spotify or wherever you stream music, but just search for Lurking Vowel and you'll be able to find all you want to listen to. So thank you. Now let's get to Nero.
Thank you.
Running the footage from the cameras I installed around each school in Atlanta, I pop a chicken nugget in my mouth as I look for any vehicles and spend a little too much time around the area. Since I started picking up Torrance slack on this investigation, Atlanta's missing children number hasn't dramatically increased. The downside to preventing more Citadel Roberts from happening is that whoever kidnapped the boys probably buried them somewhere. Unlike movies from old America, children don't come in school buses anymore. It's rare that anyone drops them off in a vehicle. When Mansur Shan designed the teleportation network, his goal was to decrease motor vehicle usage, though it's my understanding most new Americans couldn't afford cars to begin with. My biological parents sure as hell couldn't. If not at school or a public park, where do people swipe children? I know it can happen anywhere, even in someone's backyard. But what I found with each of these cases is that their parents sent them to school and never saw them again. I suppose they might have actors to pretend to be teachers or principals who walk a student off the grounds and into a van somewhere. I haven't seen any students leave the school during the day, though. Back when I took extreme measures to shut down the post office, I went to a teleportation server room and shut everything in Atlanta down. As I recall, school was canceled for a day too. Unfortunately for me, no one in New America is microchipped to determine who uses the terminals, so it's possible these kids like Citadel teleported to the wrong place, and not by their own mistake. Too bad Mansur Shan died 3 decades ago. I have no idea who maintains the network now. Because of the teleportation system, it's also not unlikely that these kids are taken all over the world. It was so easy for me to run away to Texas with Citadel. I have to mull over the impossibility of finding these children each day. I think about them more than Torrent. Something about innocent kids suffering outweighs my guilt, and the sound of his body turning to jelly beneath me. My actions against the police effectively made them afraid of me, though I find myself wanting to tell someone about my findings. They're no longer interested in these missing children. However, I walk down the street, and most people nod and smile. Some men stop to shake my hand. Women motion for me to stand by their kids when they have to tie their shoe or have some other distraction. When I left in 2137, not many of them wanted shit to do with me. If I stop pursuing these people or monitoring the schools, they may creep back to their old ways. The real lead I haven't pursued is Pearson. I thought I knew her before she tried to make me a guinea pig. Easton ran over her with my car, as I recall, so there's no way she's alive and kidnapping children. In the phone book, there's only one person by the name Pearson. Either Kason Pearson is Kate Bett's brother or father. All I need to do is confirm he knows of her. "Hello?" a man answers the phone. "Yes. Is this the Pearson residence?" I ask. "Yeah?" "I'm calling from the Birmingham Police Department. I was hoping to speak with Kate Beth."
Are you serious? Kate Beth died years ago."
"Oh, so sorry," I say. "Are you her father?" Kason hangs up the line. I wonder what hour I should pay him a visit. His address is 127 Sherman Lane. Going to my office, I have to look for Sherman on my map of Atlanta because I've never heard of it. Turns out, it's an old residential street near Austell, but very few people live past the city limits. From what I know about old American history, most smaller towns lost their populations in the 2020s because all the jobs moved to urban areas. Places like Bremen or Carrollton don't even have teleportation terminals. The Sarmenti's engine is softer than the model I owned before. Since there's no traffic, I end up in Austell in half an hour. I'm not certain if I'm going to gain anything from harassing this guy. Either he's mourning the death of his daughter, or he's helping smuggle kids around the city. With my headlights off, I can't see the mailboxes, but most homes on the street look abandoned. The only house with a light on inside has 127 posted on the door. If I pull into that driveway, there's a chance Kaysen will hear the tires over the broken concrete. Instead, I park in the grass across the street and softly shut my door. Since it's only a little after 10 p.m., he's likely awake or only recently asleep. The garage is open with a Ford truck parked inside, so I walk up to the door and look in the window to see a dark kitchen and lights on in the den. Leaning out of sight, I try turning the knob and it's locked. I can't imagine anyone wanting to come all the way out here to rob this guy. Rather than make a bunch of noise outside trying to open a window or unlock door, I put my fist through one of the small window panes to let myself in. Only a moment later, Kaysen Pearson looks up at me with a baseball bat in his hands. He's probably 5'10", perfectly clean shaven, and not nearly as young as I'd thought. "Get the fuck," he starts. I pull the bat from his grasp and place a hand on his lips. "I was with Kate Beth the night Easton killed her," I say. "My name is Nero." "Well, Nero, you owe me for the window you just broke, and I'm calling the police the moment I get your ass out of here." Pulling the man over my shoulder, he tries beating and kicking me. After a pleasant stroll to my car, I drop him in the trunk and go start the engine.
"What the hell do you want with me, asshole?"
he screams. Instead of taunting him, I turn the right off Sherman and take us back to the ramp leading to I-20. As I hear Kaysen tumbling in the trunk, I try to see if this car will rattle some windows by pressing the accelerator all the way down until I get to the first Douglasville exit and go toward an abandoned motel. We're not far from his home, but if Kaysen ran away, he'd have a hell of a time getting back. I didn't anticipate throwing him in the trunk and driving here. Am I going to drive him home and drop him off like a divorced dad on Sunday? He tries landing his foot in my stomach when I pop the door. After a hard thud on the weeds growing from cracks in the parking lot, Kaysen crawls away toward an open room without a door on the rusted hinges. All I have to do is stand on his back and listen to the breath push out of his mouth. "Kate Beth," I say. "You're a dad, right?"
"Do I look like I could be her fucking dad?" Kaysen asks. "I'm her husband. Almost ex-husband."
Kate Beth didn't wear a ring and she never told me about a husband. Plus, she was apparently fucking Easton for years. Hell, I don't even know how the divorce process in New America works. "She lived with you before the end?" I ask.
"I had to move out a week before she died."
I take my foot off his back and nudge him over.
"I found out about her fucking that old guy and wanted her out," Kaysen says. "Instead, two cops showed up out of their jurisdiction and forced me out."
"Petty," I nod. "A kid came into Central Elementary with her gun in his backpack. He was going to be the second in a series of school shootings."
"So," Kaysen says, "you think I know who had something to do with that?"
"I figured you know something, especially if you were married to her." Hopefully his shirt won't rip. Once he's off the ground, I toss him toward the GM and plant my foot in his ass. "Kaysen, if you don't give me anything, I'm going to beat you till you bleed and tuck you into one of those moldy beds."
"Hey, Dick Cheese. What if I don't know shit?"
"I hope your lungs are stronger than your lies then." Kaysen waves and shuts his eyes hard. Even if he doesn't know anything about the gun, there's something about Kate Beth I don't know.
"Kate Beth wouldn't want to hurt children. Whoever took that gun was probably in the evidence room. I used to run inventory in there. I'm the one who got her the job with APD after her schooling."
"You fired or quit?"
I ask. That piece of shit detective she was fucking had me laid off. I had no idea who would have replaced me.
So, if someone got the gun from the station, is the evidence room easier than getting in and out of the armory? Not even the commissioner has access to the guns, but hey, if a gun is sitting on a shelf with a tag on it, why wouldn't it disappear?
Okay, I say. We're going back to your place. You're going to make a phone call to whoever was your superior officer before you left. Ask them who was over evidence when Kate Beth died. Tell them you want to know if they have her ring.
No, sir, Kaysen says. I'm not talking to nobody from that goddamn police department. Go ahead and shoot me in the head or tie me upside down, whatever.
What's your aversion to the cops now? I ask.
Someone will hear the phone call. Someone a lot smarter than you. They'll come after me.
And you don't know who?
I said they were smart.
I drop Kaysen off on his exit. He can walk the rest. Considering the options, I can either go find the officer currently in charge of the evidence room and shake them until they tell me. I doubt they know, though. The look Kaysen gave me communicated a fear that originates in someone else's murder. Someone sees something they shouldn't, and they die.
How many guns have ended up in that evidence room over the years, though?
The only reason they had Kate Betts was because she had it on her at the crime scene. I evidently need to entrap a cop and have them shoot themselves, or I could get a 9mm and have someone else leave it at a crime scene. A new fireworks store opened in Grove Park last week, and it looks like a shack someone used to cook human barbecue. However, I assume they have smoke bombs. I like the ones with different colors like blue and neon green. Since it's late, the place is closed, but I make my way around back and find a small crate to carry inside. I'm surprised neighborhood kids haven't already looted the place and put it out of business. I'm about to grab some smokers when I hear the reason why. The shotgun's pump sounds louder than church bells in this quiet room. I turn to see a guy in a white shirt, suspenders, and a burgundy tie sporting a salt and pepper mustache, pretty appropriate for his age. He dresses well if he's the owner of this juvenile bait shop.
Browsing for the holidays? He asks.
If you have pellets in that gun, you might blow this whole place up, I say.
Slugs. I like to hit what I'm shooting at without cracking all the windows.
You must not see well, I say. You can see my outline. I walk closer, and he puts the barrel right on my chin. If he shoots, it'll hurt, but he better have some jib left in his jive if he's gonna outrun me. When that bullet bounces off my face, I say, I'm gonna hold you down and light one of those screamers in your ass. If you want to steal so bad, fine. Take what you want. He sets the gun on the display case and kicks the crate I took over. When I bend over to pick it up, he tries punching me in the rib cage, which mostly hurts his knuckles.
So, it's you, he says. Big freak about town.
Yeah. But usually people call me Nero.
Well, call me Caesar Salad.
While I cram all the smoke bombs into the box, the old man sits on a stool and lets out the most theatrical sigh I've heard since some college kids tried doing Shakespeare in Piedmont Park. His performance is more believable, though.
What is this a front for? I ask. You come here to bust me and take my cheapest products?
No, I say.
You happen to be closed when I needed these. I can pay you if you fire up your card reader. Take them. You're smart enough to know the loss won't really matter. I was only in here because my old lady's mad at me. You had nowhere else to go? Bars are closed, he shrugs. What's your name, by the way? I ask. Eddie, he says. A good old American name for a new American asshole.
How do you really make your money, Eddie?
Ah, come on, nobody in this world has any money. I get by with a liquor store my family built in 2095 and occasionally winning at pool. With my eyes the way they are, I ain't winning much, so it's mainly the booze and fireworks that's getting us by.
Say, Eddie, I put the crate down. How many of these would it take to fill a building with smoke?
You can get a room pretty smoky with a few, but all anyone's gonna do is open a window. If you're looking for something to get people out of a building, though, I suggest putting a bunch of cherry bombs in a bag and tossing it down a chimney or vent. Something that loud will make people run.
Well, hell, I say. I was looking forward to using the smoke.
Why not both? Go for theatrics, kid.
Eddie follows me to my car and looks up and down the street as if patrolling for giant mutant rats ready to eat us alive due to an outbreak of some new virus. I'm hoping nothing in the car causes all these fireworks to go off in my back seat. I'm missing one element, though.
You know where I can find a pistol or revolver at this hour? I ask.
Expecting to run into Clint Eastwood come sunrise? Eddie asks.
Actually, I only need the gun. It doesn't even have to work.
You never heard of a pawn shop, kid? Hold on. Stay right there.
Eddie goes back inside the store and returns only a moment later with a Colt Python with the shiniest wooden handle I've ever seen on a gun that old. The only legal manufacturing of guns in New America is for the military and police force, and neither are allowed to take their firearms when they're off duty. Of course, plenty of people break rules. Where'd you get all these toys? I ask.
You said it didn't have to work, Eddie says. And that one don't work.
Where's that liquor store of yours? I ask. I promise I'm not headed there next.
Marietta Street. Now, let me go back to sleep. If you need anything else, please bother someone else.
I have to stop midway through climbing the metal ladder leading to the roof. The only issue is that someone might spot me panting and hoping my arms don't give out. I'm carrying a little more weight on my back, but I'm supposed to be a bit more durable than this. By the time I'm up there, I have to sit down against an AC unit and let my leg stop throbbing. Pulling off the cap to the roof vent, I first drop in the smoke bombs, but I expect the cherry bombs to set them off. Maybe someone will hear the bag drop and try to investigate, which will let more smoke inside. Next, I light the wick of the bag Eddie helped me put together and drop the cherries inside before capping the hole again. Before I even get to the roof access door, the fireworks start going off, and an alarm inside starts to sound. I look down at the street leading to the entrance, and the police officers start evacuating the building. I'm not sure how long I'll have to pull this off, but I imagine I'll see men from the fire department before I run into any cops. The stairwell from the roof runs all the way to the first floor, so I put my legs over the railing, tuck my arms to my chest, and slip down, hoping I don't hit every metal bar or concrete step on the way down. My shoes crinkle under my feet when I hit the white tiles, and I look underneath to see my prints perfectly imprinted in the floor. So, I need to burn these shoes when I get home.
The evidence room is near the back of the office, and I'm coughing and struggling to see through the smoke while I make my way around the random desk and chairs. Whoever was guarding this room left the door open, which is definitely against whatever protocol they're supposed to follow. I'll tag the revolver and put it on a shelf after I print off the officer roster for this station. There's a computer near the door where all the evidence is tracked, but each officer who maintains the evidence room for the day has to sign in. I'm hoping they keep the records as far back as 2137. The printer from the movie Wall Street starts grinding out the roster when I hear the fire engine sirens right outside the door. The funny thing is that I didn't plan a way to leave out of here. Was I gonna climb back up to the roof? I can't even leave out the front door. With a wad of papers under my arm, I see their uniforms, but can't make out their faces, which means if I hunch down, they may not be able to tell it's me. I go through the emergency exit, which leads to the same alley I came through to get to the roof. This time, there are two officers standing on the edge near the street.
Ah, shit.
One of them notices me.
Fucking Nero tried to kill all of us.
Hey, this is Tenpenny. The other officer turns on his radio. We need all available officers.
I kick Tenpenny in his testicles and snatch the radio receiver off his shoulder before headbutting the other officer. Keep your mouth shut, I say. I know where both of you live. Tenpenny, you got that young boyfriend from Philly, right? Maybe I can have his balls bronzed for you.
Okay. Tenpenny holds up his hands. Rather than going directly home, I park my car at a waffle diner across from a teleportation terminal. I can go over this paperwork in Austin at my old apartment building while the police cool off. Tenpenny and his friend might still tell someone what they saw tonight. I'd hate to make good on my threat. Before I brought Citadel here, I hadn't been in Austin for over a decade. I sort of forgot about the property. Unlike the land Birch left me in Emerald Isle, I can't flip this for a profit. Everything is covered in dust, including my bedspread, so I have to change the linens before I can sleep. In the year 2137, the same officers maintained the evidence room in three shifts. Reginald Chase, Godfrey Little, and Shelton Moreland. After Kate Beth's death, Godfrey is absent from the roster. I'm sure if I went to the Atlanta Public Library and looked through the newspaper microfilm, he'd be listed in the obituaries or early retirement celebrations. His shift was 5-1. If someone lifted the gun, it was probably after dark. I'm not even sure what to do with this information, so I put my bedclothes in the wash and take a nap on the couch. That nap is interrupted 6 hours later when the sun comes through the floor-to-ceiling windows and I have to put the sheets in my dryer before they get stinky. How long before someone steals the gun I left in the evidence room and it ends up in the backpack of another kid?